It's Consumer Protection Day on the Larry Mueller Show, and I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. Our guests back with us, Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke, are from the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, otherwise known for short as DATCAP. Michelle is the administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection, and Michael is the director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. And we want to hear from you. If you have stories to tell, if you've received odd calls, perhaps strange letters, or have somehow found yourself in the web of the internet and wondering how you can escape, join the show and share your stories, ask your questions, and what we found from these conversations is your calls, your emails, they help others understand what's going on out there and prevent them from stepping into some dangerous territory. So join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can always send us an email, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Michelle and Michael, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thanks, Lee.
Always appreciate you being here and always learn something from you. And you've got stories to tell of experiences that you hear inside DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. But we also hear from our callers as well, who give us stories that sometimes you haven't heard before.
Absolutely. We love to hear those stories. One of the foundations of consumer protection is information sharing. It's the best way to recover if you've become a victim, because you are now helping others by sharing your story. But it also it spreads that prevention and awareness that we all need to have to navigate this constantly changing landscape, whether it's a new technology incorporated into a scam or whether it's just an old favorite coming around in its cycle again. We really need that information sharing.
Well, that's the thing, is I've noticed that there are some old school techniques of fraud that appear to be rearing their head once again. What's new is old, and what's old is new. So let's start with one of the old school techniques that we've seen recently, and that is letters in the mail that appear to be very official, legitimate, and worrisome.
Michael? Well, they are. You know, as we spend time talking about new technologies and new changes on scams, and we think that they're only going to take place now in that digital atmosphere, it's not true. Scammers are also aware of that, so they think, well, maybe our guard's down when it comes to those old paper letters. And that's what we're starting to see kind of circle back through. And we've had a couple instances where we've had consumers reach out and explain that they've started to receive some of these letters. The first one was from a Canadian law firm, and they were stating that this Wisconsin resident was eligible to receive this stranger's life insurance policy that was worth almost $10 million.
So $10 million, sign me up.
Again, see, there you go. That's the reaction they're looking for. They want you to key in on that. And they said that, you know, the original policyholder didn't have any family and they were looking for beneficiaries. And this particular consumer's name happened to match the family name of that individual who had allegedly passed away. But the letter had their real information, their real address. The name did match. And so where the flag came in was they were being asked to pay 10% in order for fees and lawyer fees and things to go ahead and claim that life insurance. And that was the red flag we're always looking for everyone to pay attention to, is if you're being asked to pay for any type of money that you may have won or receiving as part of a policy, that's where you should stop and pause and say, hey, wait a second. This type of letter is something that we had seen before. And even this particular scam, we're talking about letters, but this one in particular, we had seen before. And so even this, it's not really a variation, but it's kind of bringing it back through. You go into the old Rolodex and you're like, well, let's try this one again, and pull it out, start sending those letters and see who reacts.
Where are they getting our information from?
That's a question we hear a lot, and really, it could be anywhere. You know, we're aware of these data breaches that occur, and there's some information that could be garnered there. But a lot of the times, what we want to say is some of that might be out of your control, but you have a lot of control over where your information is going. And so things like maybe surveys that might pop up on social media, and all of a sudden you say, hey, this seems fun. You go ahead and you think it's innocent by adding a couple things. Well, there's some information that they're gathering. Or sweepstakes, or someone's calling with a survey. All of those things are areas where we may not even realize we're giving away information. Other ways where we're maybe signing up for a discount. You go on a website and they say, hey, you get 20% off
right,
by signing up, maybe just your email address.
Sounds
or
like
a couple
good
things.
Deal.
Sure. So there's a lot of areas that we may annoyingly be providing just little bits and pieces of our information that, you know, when these companies then aggregate that, put it together, and next thing you know, you can still have a pretty good idea of a lot of details about a particular individual.
So a red flag would be giving money in order to get money.
Always.
Always. But another red flag would be act now or time is short or you've got a limited window to get this done. Something that would make you not pause.
It is. A common theme amongst all these scams is that sense of urgency or a threat to act right now. And what those scammers want you to do is they want you to stop and not, or actually don't want you to stop. They want you to just react quickly without taking a minute to think about what's happening, to pay attention to the red flags, to act on emotion and get yourself involved to how do you fix the problem that they've created. And they're going to oftentimes explain to you what that solution will be. And that's what these letters have done. You know, another instance, we had a letter that was from some allegedly from a Medicare company that said, hey, you missed this deadline. And because you missed this deadline, you're going to miss your benefits. And so you have to do something right now. And here's how you do it. You have to call this phone number or go to this website. And of course, those are going to be fictitious and run by the scammer. But one of the common tactics in that urgency is create the problem, provide the solution, and don't give you an opportunity to ask somebody else or do a little bit of research on what they're explaining to you or how they're explaining it or learning a little bit more about this company or the situation at hand. It is that urgency that gets, unfortunately, some individuals into a habit of saying, you know what, I'm going to go and look at what's happening in front of me. That's all I'm going to pay attention to and then react to it because we want to fix problems.
What's the best way to figure out who's sending us these requests?
Well, it's just doing your research. Okay. You know, it's pausing. It's taking a second.
Stop.
Take that step back. Don't react right away to what you're seeing. It's taking a minute to maybe ask somebody else and say, hey, you know what, can you take a look at this? Does this make sense to you? Oftentimes when somebody else who's not as emotionally involved in the situation is going to look at that and say, wait a second, I can see 7 red flags that we may not see because we're not looking for them, right? We're looking to fix the problem.
Right.
And they're going to say, well, look, right here, here, here. Also doing research on things like, you know, internet searches where a lot of times if we have an experience that doesn't go right, somebody wants to tell somebody else about it. Online, you're going to hear a lot about scenarios where the same scam was perpetrated towards somebody else, and they're going to tell the world about it. So that helps us say, well, look, this letter is very similar to the other one, or the situation is very similar. And that helps us identify, too, you know what, there's something wrong here. We should stop.
So an internet search might help, but I also understand that using the internet search engines might be a danger in themselves. Well, that's a double-edged sword, Michelle.
It certainly is. You know, we're talking about that this month because it's Internet Safety Month coming up in June. And so you can't always search those. You can't always trust those search results. You need to be cautious of that because there are different tools out there. People can pay to have their search result appear on top, and companies do that all the time. And sometimes you see the little tag that says sponsor, so mm-hmm. you know, and it's not always there. It depends on the search engine that you're using. And other times, scammers are doing it. You know, they're trying to elevate themselves as well to get you to their fake, their imposter website, or their imitation opportunity, or maybe it's a service that you need to pay for where you could do it for free on your own. And let's just say renewing a driver's license type situation. You can do that for free, you know, by processing and going down to the DMV and sending in the forms that they have. But there's a service out there that will handle it for you. You pay them to process the paperwork that you need to process. So you need to be cautious about those things. And remember that those search engine optimization tools that are out there to also get results appearing more at the top can use different keyword searches. They can use bots, other artificial intelligence to elevate their name to a higher result. And scammers are going to take advantage of that as well. They're going to try and manipulate those algorithms in their favor. And so we need to be sure consumers are aware. Sometimes your answer is further down. Don't forget to scroll. And when you're clicking on a first one, do some verification before you actually completely engage. If it's a shopping experience or a data contribution experience, you still need to check out that business or organization before you engage all the way. And, you know, one thing I try to do if it's a new experience for me is take a look at how I would contact them.
Okay.
You know, I just go down to the contact us button and say, okay, what are my options here? Is there a phone number? Can I validate that another way? Is there an actual address of a business location? It's not that they have a brick and mortar presence, but they say they have a business address and location where, if I ever needed to, I could serve them, you know, type situation. But I look at that. I also look at, okay, what's my option for corresponding with them? Do they give me an email address? Do they give me business hours to engage? Do they have that live chat? Or is it just a form that I complete and submit and it goes into the abyss where I may never hear from them again? Do I have an opportunity for potential true engagement? That's one of my gut checks on engaging with a company before, you know, I go further, especially if it's a new experience. But if I'm going to go to somebody I've worked with a lot or want to, I type in the address myself.
I don't bother searching.
No, because you can end up with that imposter site. Those scammers try.
Where one letter is just different in the address.
Exactly.
And all of a sudden you look like you're in the right place, but you were in a dangerous area.
That's right. You don't notice that the O in the name is a zero.
Yes.
When you're clicking on it and you end up at that imposter place.
Are all search engines the same when it comes to protecting yourself?
I think all of them certainly bring risk, but it's what the user's putting in. It's really more about the input than necessarily the output. You know, all of these tips and best practices that Michelle just described will apply to every search engine that we're using.
Mm. So the tips here when it comes to like old school things is don't jump to anything. Don't take pause, stop. Don't give money in order to get money. When it comes to search engines, don't take the top results. Everybody does search engine optimization. Just because it's at the top doesn't mean it's legitimate. Do your own research. Figure out if you can find another way to that place where you want to go that may not be through a search engine. And that it's about you, that it's about what you're giving to the search engine and your behavior. It's not, I mean, we can't really control how they're trying to get to us.
No, we can only control our reaction to what they're trying to get from us. And I also say that very cautiously because we can control our reaction. However, they are using so much manipulation.
Yes.
That we need to also forgive ourselves if we don't see those red flags, not punish ourselves for that. And Michael and I talk about this quite a bit, that we need people to report, but if they're punishing themselves, they may not. I should have seen that. And that's where that take that moment to stop and think and talk to someone else. As he described, they may see the red flags because they're not caught up in the tactic of the emotional response of, wow, this is awesome. I could do so much with that $10 million. Or that, oh my gosh, I really need to get this solved because I don't want to be on a negative list with whatever company and having those overdue bills that'll really impact my credit.
Yep.
I mean, you're going to these places where your brain is reacting and not thinking rationally, whereas someone else who's removed from the situation can just truly look at it for what it is.
What's the best way to get a hold of the Bureau of Consumer Protection?
Well, you can call our hotline at 1-800-422-7128 or visit us online at datcp.wi.gov.
datcp.wi.gov, and the phone number
800-422-7128.
7128. That's 800-422-7128 for questions and sharing your own stories. And we've got a bunch of them lined up here, so we'll get to them next. Just give me a minute. Michelle Ryan and Michael Domke, our guests from DAPCAT's Bureau of Consumer Protection. Your calls when we continue. I'm Lee Rayburn on The Larry Mueller Show. Our guests, Michael Domke and Michelle Reinen from the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, talking about consumer protection today with ear input as well. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry on The Larry Mueller Show. And let's go straight to your stories and questions for our guests. We'll start with Rick in Bell Center. Rick, good morning.
Good morning. I have three things for you. The first happened 2 weeks ago when I got a call. I didn't answer it. I listened to the voicemail. It was somebody calling and saying that there was an investigation of my clinical practice. I'm an MD. And I thought, well, that's the strangest thing to ever hear from. And I plugged in the phone number. It was New Jersey, and it was just nothing, garbage. And the other thing that bothered me was the fact that the person, it was a woman speaking on the message just went so fast and garbled up some things. So I thought, this is absurd. And so I just ignored it. And I wondered to myself, how many other MDs are getting calls like that? Second thing was yesterday, I got an email from PayPal saying that there was to be a charge of $1,099 against my PayPal account unless I called them right away. And they sort of did themselves in, because 2 hours later, I got another message saying the same thing from a different email address, which I checked out with junk. I checked the number they gave to call as the customer service number, and that was junk also. And I went to see what the customer service number was for PayPal that was legit, and that was different than either of the two numbers in the email, so I just ignored all that. And about 2.5 weeks ago, I got an email offering to renew my passport, which doesn't expire for another year. And it made it look kind of official, like it was from the Department of State or something, but I was suspicious of that as well and just ignored that. I've never received any sort of request to renew my passport in times past, so I don't know how that happened. I would guess that they got my information about the bogus examination of some clinical practice issue from the database of the physicians in the state of Wisconsin, which is publicly available.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my three stories, and a lot of the things I did were to check out the phone number, go find out what the real phone number for PayPal was, and et cetera.
Rick, you did your work, and fortunately for you, but shoot, is the way I think about it is we're all getting those voicemails, right? And the PayPal attempts at scams, I just feel like we've all gotten those as well, that Rick's not unique in any way other than perhaps he's a doctor and they seem to figure that out, but the voicemails, the emails, the passports...
Well, Rick definitely is not the only one that is receiving that PayPal scam. This is something that our hotline receives every single month. It's in the top five probably scams we get calls about regarding those fake invoices that come in and they're saying, you know what, you paid for something. Oftentimes we're seeing it being cryptocurrency and saying that you purchased some Bitcoin and you now need to pay that balance. And I think they're using that because a lot of us haven't bought any Bitcoin, but it's done electronically. So we start to wonder, did somebody else buy that on my behalf or
sure.
use my, and we're not maybe familiar as much with the cryptocurrency. So it adds a potential fear of this might be real and gets us to react to it. But we've seen those invoices for a lot of things and it's continuing to kind of spread throughout. The industry license one is a situation we have heard about, not necessarily, at least me personally, in the MD field, but we are hearing about it in other industries where they're getting potentially lists of licensees or maybe getting information about a particular career field, and then they're sending out information saying there's something wrong with your credential or you haven't renewed or there's an additional fee, and you know there may be purporting to be a particular agency that issues that license or there may be a supporting agency. Recently we heard about forensic nurses who are being targeted.
Wow.
And saying, you know what, there's an issue with your license, and then also getting some fake subpoenas being sent to them. So there's variations in all these things that aren't particular or specific to one industry that says it's only you who's going to be targeted. They're going to try and hit all of them. And then that passport scam, that's in one where we've heard about it. We understand that they're going to try and reach out, and especially with these recent laws, it's been changed with Real ID and how you might need additional information. Scammers key in on those key, kind of we call them life points, where they're going to say, here's a new opportunity for us to try and exploit a situation that a consumer might be aware of, or it's going to add legitimacy to what we're asking about and get them to react quickly.
And Michelle, it seems as though Rick did his due diligence and was able to just save his identity, save his practice, save his money.
He sure did. He actually reminded me of a situation I had about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and it's a little different, but it tells the same story, and that's I was in the middle of the workday, but I just happened to be between meetings and got a phone call, and it was a number that I, you know, kind of recognized, but it didn't come up with a label. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure I know that number. So I answered it. I'm very cautious with that. And it was the clinic, you know, checking on an appointment I'd made a year ago, but the doctor changed their schedule and we need to reschedule this. And I'm like, okay. And then they said, can I have your date of birth? I go, you know, I'm in between meetings and I start to go, what? And I go, wait, no, I can't do that. And she goes, excuse me? And I said, you called me. I can't give you that. And so, you know, I said, I'll call you back. What's the number? So I took down the number she wanted me to call. But then I went to my other, you know, business card that I had for the clinic and called the number on there. Sure enough, same lady answered the phone. And then Oof. I said, you know, I work at Consumer Protection. I really have to practice what I say. And I said, you almost tripped me up because, but she goes, no, I understand. I don't get that nearly enough. And I was,
oh, wow.
Yeah. And, you know,
so she wasn't put out. She was surprised that this didn't happen more often.
She did
her.
Sound a little put out at the moment because she's trying to get her work done and get all these people rescheduled because of the change. But at the same time, when I called back and said, why? She's like, oh, yeah, no, I get that kind of thing. But I, in that moment, distraction, knowing what we do and saying this every day, almost got caught up. So I really applaud Rick and everybody who does take that minute to do that verification and see all those disconnects and wasn't matching.
What's unfortunate to me is I do not use PayPal because of the PayPal scam. That I avoid that account entirely. It doesn't have anything current in there. I think I had it from a decade ago or so. Do either of you use PayPal?
I do use PayPal.
I do because of certain things, it's the only option. Okay.
It's that, and then I also like it because if you are making online purchases, you now really only have to put it in to PayPal versus now you're going to enter your payment information into every single website you're buying from.
Oh.
So we may think, hey, we're worried about PayPal, but in reality, we've now given it to 10 other websites.
We have seen PayPal step up a bit on some of their fraud and their reimbursements as well, not to endorse anything.
No,
but
I bring it up because they've got a strong ad campaign right now that's really pushing PayPal, and yet at the same time, I feel a pushback because of my fears.
They have really been, because they were one of the first, really taken advantage of with the imposter and scams and websites. And with those big names, international, you really have to be cautious to know how you're going to navigate. So when you get that email that something suspicious, you have to go log in and check. Just don't even bother clicking a link. Yeah. Let it be, someone comes to your door and says, time to donate. Let it be your reminder to go donate the way you normally would. You don't have to respond in that moment. Let it be the reminder to go do things through your normal path.
And just if I could piggyback real quick, is also these scammers, they know a lot of people use PayPal because they've been around for a long time.
Right.
So it's not necessarily that PayPal is being targeted because there's some type of vulnerability. It's they know how many users are out there. It's just like a lot of phishing scams where it's what is a particular area or situation or event where we know a lot of people might be involved in it. When we saw our toll text scam that went out last month, they know it's during spring break. A lot of people might be traveling. And so it doesn't mean that everyone is, but it's, hey, higher likelihood than not that someone's going to have a PayPal, may have been traveling. So you just toss it out there. And that's why PayPal is so prevalent.
They're phishing.
They're phishing.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the call, Rick. We'll go to Claire in Baraboo next. Claire, good morning.
Hi, Lee. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
I remember in the bad old days hearing about scammers putting skimmers on gas pumps to read credit card information. A, does that still happen? And B, is it true that when you use chip reader function, they cannot scan the information?
Good questions, Claire. I'd be interested in the answer. Michelle?
Yeah, so actually, I hate to say it, but yes, there are still skimmers out there. And our Bureau of Weights and Measures inspectors are out there inspecting gas pumps to be sure a consumer gets a gallon when they pump a gallon. But they also take a look at the device. And
I did
so
not know
they
that.
Are checking for the skimmers. Law enforcement checks when they get reports of consumers having, frauds on their credit cards and things. So there is an active review of this out there. And there is technology that also allows for the chip readers to be compromised. While that is less frequent, there is technology that can allow for that reading as well. We just encourage consumers to test it. You know, take the device that's going to be you're going to put your card in and test it. Does it wiggle? Does it jiggle? You know, you see a little pinhole that could be a camera reader if you have to insert your digits for a passcode? Or just, do the overlay
cover
on your hand.
Your hand.
One can see this on the radio, Lee. But,
physically protect your, visibly protect your information.
Exactly. And the other option is it's the unattended places that are going to be more concerning. So if you go to a place that's got high volume, big turnover, and it's very attended, even though it might be self-service, that's going to be probably lower value for a scammer to get at versus something that's truly unattended and not super high volume as far as the customer service or the owner being in there operating the device, because it will be a longer period before it's discovered.
What about tap to pay with your cell phone? Is that an effective and safe measure, or have they figured out a way to get in between that transaction?
Well, I'm glad you said with your cell phone, because there's two variations on how you can tap. First is with your card,
sure.
And then the second is with your cell phone. And the data has shown that using your cell phone is more secure than just your card.
Oh, wow.
Because when it's sending out that signal, most phones will have a little bit of encryption to it. And so that signal that's going through is harder to decrypt and figure out what is actually being transmitted. The card is static, so you know what it's sending every single time. There's no other electronics on that to send it. So as Michelle was talking about those risks of, you know, slow aping and putting in the chip, tapping is safer than those two options. Using your phone is just a little bit safer than those two options. And, of course, walking in and paying with cash is the safest manner to do it. But we're always in a hurry. So
yeah, I was
going to
say, it may
that.
Not be the most convenient method. And yeah. I feel like I wondered about tapping with my phone, because I found myself doing that more often than not and wondering, well, you know, how will somebody figure out how to get between that and the transaction? But that's a little bit safer than tapping with your credit card, and that's a little bit safer than inserting the chip, and that's a little bit safer than swiping the magnetic strip.
Yeah, I'm going to put a little wrench in that, though. You
got
to be sure that you're keeping your phone safe. You need to keep your operating system up to date. You need to be sure it's locked down and protected and your wallet's locked. So should you lose your device or it's stolen,
yes.
You don't end up with a very large compromise there. So we're always a sunshiny day here.
Michelle Ryan and Michael Domke, our guests for our Consumer Protection Day. And we will continue with your calls now. Barbara in Middleton, good morning.
Good morning, Lee and guests, and thank you for this program. For at least the last year, I've been receiving phone calls. I try not to answer if I don't know the number, but occasionally I do. It's a man who, when I pick up, says, "Usha," and I just hang up. The beginning of a year, I'm so fed up with this person calling. And he said, "Usha," and I said, "You've got to come up with a better name." Now the calls have intensified, and they're always from the same area code, a different, sometimes the same exchange, but it's driving me crazy.
Understandable, Barbara. I would want to know how we could put a stop to that. Can you block a phone? Well, it's an area code, but not necessarily the same seven digits.
Yeah, given the nature of this call, she may want to call her telecommunications provider to report it there to see what they can do in any kind of interruption and disruption to the call, a block that way, because it's this very patterned type of call and harassing, they may have more information versus a random auto dialer scammer situation.
It sounds like an attack. It sounds
a bit more unique.
It does. You know, I agree. Calling the carrier to see what options they may have. If I don't know, Barbara said it's starting to change a little bit. If she's seeing, I mean, it's a manual effort, but each time she could just block every number that they are calling from. And if that could get cumbersome, if it changes every single time, mm-hmm. if it's the same three or four phone numbers, there's an opportunity. But it also, you know, that reaction or that engagement might just encourage them to keep calling back and keep calling back.
So your recommendation, Michael, would be to not engage. And when you hear that male voice on the other end, to just hang up, identify the phone number and see if there's a way you can block it on your end or have the telecommunications company block it on theirs. If it's an area code that's seldom used or they seldom receive phone numbers from, would there be the potential to block an entire area code? I don't think that is something I've heard of before.
I'm not sure if you can do that. I'm not aware.
Yeah. But at what point would you bring in the authorities here? When can law enforcement play a role here? If there is harassment going on, and I feel like the one thing that we fall short on is having law enforcement step in on some of these stories.
Well, law enforcement's engagement would be kind of depending on what's being said. You know, with that, there is, you know, laws that do prohibit using a phone in a harassing manner mm-hmm. and making threats and so on. And law enforcement will follow up on that. But it doesn't necessarily sound like this is the verbal threats being made or those conversations. And that's really where law enforcement, the practice of just repeatedly calling that phone number, that one's a little bit tougher to get into, depending on whether or not they're
I could see that
on a list. Now, if they're
it's just frustrating.
Well, it is, and we have a law that if you're calling, you know, and habitually harassing someone, and they're on the do not call registry, you know, that's something we could potentially look into and follow up. If it's the same phone number, we can recognize who it is and so on. But
the do not call registry would be for businesses. It's not necessarily for politicians or politicking. It's not for individuals. It's just for incorporated business structures.
Right. It's not for scammers. Right. They need to be in the act of a solicitation. So we are able to get at some scammers that way and in that piece of it. And then there's the federal do not call registry and telephone solicitor act there. So between the different venues, we sometimes have the ability to get at certain actions, but we don't know exactly what this is with this individual. And so
neither does Barbara.
No, she doesn't. And so that's where I think first action item could be to reach out to the provider to see what they can do to put that blocking in place. Her own other action is to try to minimize answering, which is going to be very difficult.
You'd identify that area code and not pick it up. And if you do pick it up, do not engage.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I just wait. I don't even say hello because then I get the dirt, you know, the little click. I can't even make
the sound. No, that was pretty good. I think you got it nailed down.
There, right, says, oh, look, now it's the robot or it's going to be the automated voice response or the auto dialer got me and the call center's on the other line and I just immediately hang up then.
But being old school from landline days.
And I have a landline. Have a landline.
Like that is your polite thing to do is pick up and say hello or how you doing, but maybe try just not saying anything and wait for them to make the first move.
Right.
Best of luck, Barbara, and thank you for sharing your story. We'll go to Jonah in Greenville next. Jonah, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
What's your story?
So last year, there were a lot of cyber attacks in the U.S. in like medical and financial things or sectors, and it seemed to be getting worse. And nothing, at least at the federal level, was being done, in my view, to stop it. So I feel like we haven't been focusing on cybersecurity as much as we need, and therefore, I decided last year to change pretty much all of my passwords. Among other security things, but my tip, as annoying as it sounds, it did make me feel a lot better. I changed every password to just the most crazy series of letters and ampersands and exclamation points and things you can imagine.
Jonah, I want to know from you how you keep track of those passwords. What do you do to keep track of them?
Yes, that's what I was just about to say. I wrote them down in a bunch of places in my house.
So there's a paper trail, but you wouldn't be able to get through to it anywhere online. Changing all of his passwords last year. How long did that take, Jonah?
Gosh. You know, I don't know that I have an answer. I can't even remember, if I'm being honest. I think it took a couple weeks to just go through everything.
Sure, but the peace of mind was worth the time.
Absolutely. And I found it satisfying each time. If I'm being honest, because I feel guilty all the time when I create a new password and it's just the same essentially as all my other passwords. And the website's like, hey, you better not be using your same password as other. And I'm like, I am.
Well, Jonah, I think it's interesting because this is my mom's method for passwords. She's got a password diary that she uses. She writes it down and it's nowhere else to be found. Which could cause for some confusion, but also that it is a level of safety that cannot be accessed anywhere on the internet.
Jonah's got a great practice. changing those passwords regularly is certainly a great precaution that we can take. And that guilt, I've had that guilt the same time, saying, well, I know what I'm doing here, but we get into a sense of complacency and it's easy, and remembering all of those passwords, because we may have 30 different places to try and keep those, can be challenging. I really applaud Jonah for doing that, because it does make it difficult if one of those passwords were to be compromised and it's used everywhere. What these scammers will do is they'll match up whatever username or whatever email address was used across all these platforms, and then they just try to use that one password. And if we're using the same one all over, well, now maybe we had it compromised in one area, but now it gets compromised in 30 areas, which is why we always advocate for changing those passwords often, especially if you get a red flag, but then not using the same one on across all different areas.
Jonah, I appreciate the tip, and kudos to my mom for being internet secure when the rest of us are using password savers and using the web browser to save our passwords.
Old school is new.
That seems to be the theme of the day with our guests, Michael Dofke and Michelle Ryan, and talking consumer protection. And we'll go next to Rich in St. Germain. Rich, good morning.
Hi. Yeah, I was trying to get on my Facebook account. The same as I always do. And I keep getting a message that's saying I've been blocked from Facebook for some reason or another, and I never did nothing funny. But they wanted me to take a selfie of my face, and I never took a selfie on my laptop before in my life, and I don't know how to do it anyway, but they said take a selfie of your face and move your head back and forth. And another one I looked on, they wanted a picture of my photo ID, like a driver's license.
That sounds very strange, Rich. And have you been able to access Facebook since?
The message said, I think this is a scam, and I can't get a hold of Facebook even, because every time I try to get a hold of them, they say you've been blocked.
Wow. This is a tough one.
Yeah, we're familiar with Facebook accounts getting, you know, hacked or compromised or blocked for certain things. This is the first I've heard of Facebook asking for both a visual scan and, of course, the driver's license. Definitely red flags for me, having not heard from it, but I would be surprised if Facebook was asking for that much information to get back into the account, but I can't verify that.
So how would you reaccess Facebook? It's Facebook's one of those things that if you try to reach out to a customer service, it would be hard to figure out where Facebook's customer service would be.
Well, I think if you just do the general search, I mean, they have several customer service lines depending on the issues that you have. And so if you just go to their general site, maybe if the app you can't get in anymore, doing it through a separate, and you don't have to log in to get their customer service information. So just a general internet search.
What have you heard, Michael, when it comes to people getting locked out of Facebook and having to find their way back in?
Often it has to do with identity theft, and either their login and password getting compromised, and then getting locked out of their own account. And where certainly that's frustrating for individuals, but it's also very frustrating for those that are using that account for a business, and that is their sole point of contact. You know, if you do those internet searches, you'll see a lot of businesses don't have a website anymore. They just have a Facebook account.
Right.
That's where they post everything and advertise. So we see those getting compromised and getting taken over. Or we also see them not just getting locked out, but then someone else just using the information within that account, the friends network, the groups that they're in, and then starting to perpetrate scams because we won't realize. So all of a sudden, say you and I are in the same group. I know you, Liam. You reach out to me and say, hey, here's a great opportunity to maybe invest or buy this, or we're going to go on this trip.
Yep.
And I think it's actually coming from you.
Right.
And so I go ahead and jump in and spend that money and realize, oh, you know what, it actually wasn't you. It was somebody else who had taken over your account.
Rich, I hope you follow up with us and let us know what comes of it. And I would be very interested to see what you do. Just be careful with the information that you have that is yours and who you give it to. And see if you can't find customer service somewhere in Facebook that can give you a lift. Our guest with the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection today, Michelle Reinens, the administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. Michael Dofke, director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection, here to help you. And thank you for sharing your story so far at 1-800-642-1234. They continue next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry on The Larry Miller Show. It's Consumer Protection Day on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry and our guests, Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke from our Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, here to help you. And thanks again for sharing your stories. We'll get right back to them here with Patrick and Madison. Patrick, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. What do you have for us?
Good. Well, a couple of things that I do. I've turned on multi-factor authentication for all of my bank accounts and my retirement accounts. Mm. Also, all of my credit cards. And another thing I've done is I've turned on a notification on my my checking account that any transaction a dollar or over, they send me an email. And then the other thing that I do is you can get a copy of your credit report once a year from the three major credit reporting agencies. So every 4 months, I use that and go in and check my credit report.
Patrick, those sound like I'm wondering how much time do you put into this and whether or not you feel that your time is worth the investment here?
It really it didn't take too long to set up the multi-factor authentication, and it doesn't take much time at all just to, you know, look at the transactions that are happening as they come through my email and archive them.
Worth the peace of mind?
Definitely.
There are three steps there. Let's start with multi-factor authentication. Perhaps not everybody knows what it is, but if you have to use passwords for work like I do, that is certainly standard now for most business networks. Multi-factor authentication, a good idea?
A wonderful idea. And if I had balloons and confetti, it'd be going off right now for all that Patrick's doing, because he's kind of the model of everything we say to put in place for monitoring. You know, use multi-factor authentication, and it's that second layer. So think going into your house, you have the key to the doorknob, but you have the deadbolt. This is the deadbolt to get you in. It's just putting in an extra. You have your password, but you have an extra. Maybe they text you a six-digit number that you have to put in. Maybe you have a token that you have to do by going to a different app. But it's just putting in an extra layer of information that's unique to you and usually unique in that moment as well. Not something you remember over time, because it's in that moment that you get it through your secure communication method. So it's a wonderful thing. And, you know, I have one thing to give Patrick that he could ramp up his game just a little bit more. And that's that with that free credit report, you can do that every week now if he does it online. Free.
Every week?
Yes.
I thought maybe every 4 months was too often.
Well, no. So nationally, you're permitted to once a year get your credit report if you're doing it by mail, you know, if you're going on that way and checking it. And that's been around for years and years and years. But during COVID, because of all the shenanigans going on, they did basically, I'll call it a pilot, but a trial where you could check it online weekly. And they've extended that. And, you know, that's a permanent thing now if you're checking it online. So you can be monitoring at a higher frequency with each of them. He doesn't have to rotate that one time across those three credit reporting agencies now if he wants to ramp up the monitoring. But right now, I'm still going to say that's model behavior that we would love if everyone would do that.
The third step he uses is notifications for transactions.
Yeah. I would say I agree. This is perfect. And you asked a great question about, is the time worth it? And all the things that Patrick did here really don't take that long to sign up for. But in addition, using those is even easier. So the notification,
yes,
there's no effort made.
It's passive.
You sign up and it's
right
there.
To you. Yeah.
Very similar with like the USPS, it has informed delivery where you can sign up and it'll send you pictures of what your mail should look like. So you sign up once and there's no effort. Even with the multi-factor, I understand how sometimes we thought, well, this is a pain because then I have to go here. But even if you get it texted, a lot of the software and the operating systems for our phones will now pre-populate it for you when you get it. So you have no effort. You just push it,
and
you're
done. Button.
And it adds such a higher level of security for that, I don't know, 1-2 seconds of your time.
So three steps here that all of us can consider and time versus peace of mind. Peace of mind seems to win out every time. That's multi-factor authentication on your accounts, which is more than just a password. It's a second step, but it should be a simple one. It should also be ephemeral enough that it changes on a regular basis. Your credit report, as often as once a week, if you like. Patrick is doing it every couple of months, and that seems to work for him. And then getting notifications on your transactions, and that should be available through almost, I would imagine, all banks and all credit cards.
Yeah.
Yep. Way to go, Patrick. Thank you so much for the information. Paul and Phillips, we'll go to you next. Good morning.
Good morning. Actually, just finished up on something that I'll speak to right here. But the previous caller that talked about making the complex passwords and then writing them down on a slip of paper. And I had done that for years. And I finally have a device that's a standalone little handheld thing that's like a password vault, if you will. And so then you only have to remember one maybe complex password. You know, obviously you don't want 1, 2, 3, 4, but that way it's completely isolated from your computer, because I've always worried about like the password managers embedded in, you know, the web browsers and whatnot. I don't know, they're probably secure, but this way, it's just not even on the system.
So is your password vault like a notebook that's not on the internet? Is it, what are you using for that?
Like a sharper image kind of thing, and it encrypts, it encrypts the data. And, you know, you put your passwords in there, and all you have to do is remember one complex password. And what I've read, you know, studying this, I'm a little bit cautious, is a passphrase is actually even as good or better than just a series of random numbers that you and letters you can't remember.
Yeah, that's
and you can mix it up with special characters.
Sure. So a password vault, a password manager, passwords in the web browser, using phrases as opposed to complex strings. What do you think, Michael?
I think these are all great tips. And, you know, I think what it comes down to, and we always talk about, is getting on here and laying out the scenarios that maybe you should be aware of, and then the tools and maybe some of the best practices you can employ when you want to, or employ when you want to use them. But it comes down to individually managing that risk and you deciding this is what the amount of effort I'm going to put into managing the risk, and I'm going to accept other types of risk if I decide I don't want to put in that effort. Paul laid out a good one where he said, you know what, those password managers that are in the operating systems, he doesn't feel comfortable with those.
Yep.
Great. Well, then he's going to choose to use a separate password manager. Others may say, you know what, I trust the operating system. I'm going to go ahead and not use something separate. I'm going to go there. It's really coming down to here's the best practice, and you can say I'm willing to commit all this time to do all these things, recognizing that it's going to have potentially a cost to my time. And there's others that say I value my time. I'm not going to do any of that, and I'm willing to just throw it in the wind and see what happens and hope for the best.
What happens to your time when you do have your identity stolen or you are notified that your password has been hacked?
It's a great question. Recovering your identity can take years. And so that's it can take years, literally.
If you can even recover it completely.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is not uncommon for us to hear individuals that we've been working with or talk to that are 3-4 years into it, because we have such a wide digital footprint right now. And so you don't necessarily
know
where it might be. And so we can help fix those big things, you know, with the creditors and the lenders and the things that we deal with day to day. But just if you fix it in the 10 areas, but you didn't realize that there was 13 of them, those three might continually have that residual effect on you not understanding how you can get those fixed or that they're still impacting you.
And it can be expensive. So we're not just talking our own time. It can have a financial cost to repairing your identity as well.
Like how much?
Well, that can vary. It's going to depend on the type and if you can get everything forgiven, because you may have to pay for debt that's been taken out in your name if you can't prove that it wasn't you. And it can cost you money to try and prove that. So, you know, if
credit
you can
card
do
has
the
some fraud protections, right?
There are some fraud protections with a credit card, yes. But we've seen situations where a credit card company with a scam has declined. That in the customers because they've been engaged in the transaction. It's just they weren't engaged knowingly, like completely, but the credit card company has not accepted the dispute. That could change if they were to continue to see a pattern of other reports. I mean, that can always be a reverse decision. But again, that's time and that's expense. So what Michael says is everyone has to make their own personal choice and decision and determine what risk, what consequences they can potentially accept should it happen to them, or when it happens to them, is how some people think of it.
Michelle Ryan and Michael Domke, our guests from the Wisconsin Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. It is your Consumer Protection Day, and we will continue with your stories after a look at our news, and get to your emails as well. Sorry, I haven't touched on those yet, but those are still to come. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Larry Mealer Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is WPR News. It's the Larry Mealer Show, and it's Consumer Protection Today with your help and our guests. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry, and Michelle Reinen's with us. She's the administrator of the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection, as is Michael Domke, director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. Before I give out the phone numbers, I also want to get to some emails here, and I appreciate everybody who's hanging on the line and everybody who wants to get an answer to their stories from our guests, Michelle and Michael. So let's get right to the emails. We'll start with Cindy in Green Bay, who said she's recently received a number of emails from the Social Security Administration. Very good replicas of logos, very close match in websites. The address gave it away, though. She's received about five of them in the past 5 months. Another concern is the number of solicitations. Cindy's 90-plus-year-old in-laws receive daily mail donations, mail solicitations for donations, many nonprofit organizations asking for money, and it's difficult to get her off these mailing lists, some for phone calls from fundraising organizations. Let's start with Cindy's 90-plus-year-old in-laws and what they can do to avoid some of these solicitations, whether they're in the mail or over the phone.
Yeah, so it can be difficult to get off charitable solicitation mailing lists, but you can individually contact each one. And like she said, that can be challenging to do, but they often will recognize and honor your request, but it can take 30 days. You can also contact the Direct Mail Association, and we have that information on our website, to be put on a stop mail list, and it would remove your name from being put on Direct Marketing Association mailing lists that are purchased, and so you wouldn't get added to new lists.
Okay.
And it lasts for 5 years, and then you need to renew. So that is an option to try and minimize and take a step back from things that you're getting. Phone calls, same thing with charitable organizations. You can request to be put on their internal do not call lists. Now, if you're on the state's do not call list, that is for those organizations or companies that solicit their merchandise and goods. And if you're getting calls from them, certainly report them to Consumer Protection so we can follow up. And, you know, sometimes when you've made that request of a charitable organization and they just haven't honored it yet or acknowledged it, filing a complaint and having Consumer Protection reach out can have some results. We have no authority. There's nothing official that they have to do, but often through our reaching out and mediation, that can assist. But we do ask that you do that first attempt.
The website, datcp.wi.gov. That's datcp.wi.gov. The phone number, 800-422-7128. That's 800-422-7128. If you didn't get that information here, you will find it on the show episode page today after the show online at WPR.org/Larry. And Michael, what about these Social Security Administration scams?
These are the government imposter scams that we hear about so much. And Social Security Administration is one of the top agencies that is targeted because so many people in America may be participating in the program or receiving benefits. And so as we spoke earlier about casting that net out there to see who might respond to it, what we want everyone to do to recognize is first, Social Security Administration is not going to call you asking for information. These emails where they're going to demand you respond or make some threats on how you have to react to a certain date or provide certain information back in that email. We want, just like every time, don't respond to those. Just take a second, pause, think about what's happening, and recognize that the Social Security Administration is going to send you a letter if there is anything that you need to do, any change in your benefits, any programs that need to be adjusted. But also, even those letters, as we spoke about earlier, those can also be fabricated. So the key here in all of these is to know who you're contacting and making sure that you're using a trusted phone number or trusted email address when you're reaching out. It is controlling that communication where you're not responding to anything that they're giving you or telling you to do. You're initiating that contact back to the Social Security Administration through a number that may be on the back of your card, maybe through that website search that you recognize as their real agency website, but using that contact information you know is real.
Something from Amy, who emailed us saying she's been targeted by scams almost daily, and I certainly know it can feel that way. And this about owing money for tolls, and I know you've talked about this before, but this seems to be an ongoing scam in Wisconsin. Amy checked her Illinois tolls and found she doesn't know anything. Also figured that since we're in Wisconsin and it doesn't have tolls, there's a red flag there already. She just deletes the text, but says others should know about this.
She's absolutely right. Just delete those texts. And we have issued two consumer alerts about this when we were getting hit really hard in late March, early April, and it continues on. And they are text messages that consumers are receiving. Some are getting emails. They look like they are coming from EasyPass, Wisconsin DOT, Illinois Tolling, all sorts of names that would seem like they're familiar or something you'd want to respond to. And because we're a state that's on the border of a state that has tolls, it can create confusion. But because we are a state that doesn't have tolls, people aren't always familiar as to how it actually works. And that's that you need to, when you go through a tolling area, go log into that tolling state's website and then find your license plate and pay your toll. Or you set up an account if you live there or regularly travel through. But what doesn't happen is when you drive through, it magically gets your phone number and reads it, and then they text you and say it's time to pay. You have to go do that. And you know, they're just the scammers trying to create confusion, that mass targeting of our border state. And with spring break, people traveling to southern states that have them as well, it has created quite a ruckus here. And we need people just to delete them.
Just delete them. Renee in Viroqua emailed, she's unable to get the free credit report. Every time she's tried, she does not get anywhere with it. So how can you go about getting your free credit report?
Well, really, she should be going to the annualcreditreport.com. Is it .com?
That's something we got to look. We don't want
to. It's annualcreditreport.something. And that's really where you need to be going to get that free copy of it.
I get annualcreditreport.com, the only source for your free credit reports authorized by federal law.
So going to that website is where, when we were speaking earlier about how you can get that online copy once a week.
Renee asked, is it freecreditreport.com, which I've seen advertised before, and we're talking about getting a free credit report, but that's not the website for it.
So Renee has provided a perfect example of how website searches might be confusing and misleading by the titles that they're using or the website names that they use.
Yeah.
Annualcreditreport.com is the one source that you should be using.
Annualcreditreport.com. We'll add that to the list of links on our episode page online at WPR.org/Larry. I'll put that in there. I'll put that in there before I forget. I appreciate the email. That is valuable. Annualcreditreport.com and not freecreditreport.com. Phoebe in Fitchburg emailed, last week while looking for a drone on Facebook. That sounds like fun. Facebook Marketplace. She clicked on an item labeled Wayfair Daily Sales. The site had Wayfair's logo, header, everything. The Wayfair, I'd imagine, the furniture website. So she purchased it. The next morning, Phoebe logged into her Wayfair account and no such purchase showed up. She went back to the website and all the contact us info went nowhere. Phoebe was eventually refunded. For what it's worth, looking at Facebook Marketplace today, Phoebe's seen this same scam posting for multiple other items. Posing as Wayfair on Facebook Marketplace, you wouldn't think that Wayfair would need to be doing that.
You wouldn't. Unfortunately, Phoebe encountered one of those fictitious scammer ads that we see also frequently on social media platforms. And this is, you know, we talk about how making sure that you're recognizing how you got to where you are to make that purchase. And so if you saw that that promotion and you clicked on that and it led you to what you thought was Wayfair's website, that's where we want users to pause and say, okay, wait, maybe I should go to Wayfair's website directly, because scammers are going to create both ads that look just like a legitimate Wayfair ad, but they're also going to create fictitious websites that mirror what the real websites look like. And Wayfair isn't unique to this. We see a lot of businesses that have fictitious websites out there, and then they're promoted on social media with oftentimes prices that are significantly lower than what those products are, and that's what entices those users to click on those links and go to that website and make those purchases. And what they're trying to do is get that personal information when you get to that purchase screen, and then, of course, your payment information. And then when you go to the legitimate Wayfair, you'll realize you never made that purchase. And unfortunately, through that scam, you've unknowingly given away that info.
Well, fortunately for Phoebe, she did get a refund. Mike emailed us. He uses a federal government website periodically. ID.me is evidently an authentication process. Can you describe or evaluate this website?
I can't describe it other than I am aware of the website and a lot of... So for me personally, I was in the military, and for me to access some of my government records, I need to do the ID.me in order to access those. It's kind of that the multi-factor authentication where it
says
for
the federal government?
For the government websites that I've been accessing. It does give you other options. I just know ID.me is the one I've been using. I can't describe it other than it's more of an authentication aspect to provide you access.
Patricia from Anago has an email here. She's an attorney, and the worst scams that she's seen are the romance scams, where the scammer impersonates a man interested in the woman and asks for money, or most recently sent a check for purchasing a home with a woman. The check was from a law firm, but the account had been closed. The victim sent over $30,000 to the scammer before the $40,000 check bounced. Another woman took over $100,000 out of an IRA. This is kind of hard to read, and sent it to the scammer and ended up without the money and a tax debt to the IRS. It makes me want to curse, Michelle.
Yes, Patricia's absolutely right. These scams are not the highest volume reported scams, but they are the scams with the highest losses to consumers and individuals. And those examples that she provided prove that. These are long-term scams. They are emotionally charged scams. Often we are seeing a new twist to them where it's involving artificial intelligence. And so they're getting harder to identify as being a scam, because we used to say, go ahead, check the individual's profile, Google it, do a reverse image search on the photo, see if you see many different profiles.
But AI can fake all that.
AI can fake all of that. So it's getting harder now. AI can allow this scammer to have multiple conversations and engage remotely with different individuals and many storylines now
with those different profiles. So it seems like you're interacting with a human, but it's just a chatbot.
Yeah, it's much harder now to see them. So you have to recognize the red flags of never meeting in person, having personal emergencies, love bombing, too much emotion too soon, too early in the relationship, schemes to invest together to forge and bond and build trust in your relationship and be connected by investing in cryptocurrency together. but these are the tactics they're using. And when you are engaged in a place where you think you've found that someone, you aren't going to see those red flags. So this is where friends and family and community have to carefully navigate and be engaged with this individual, this person who's involved with the scammer, to carefully navigate again, tiptoe through identifying the red flags and being sensitive that you don't get shut out of it. Because certainly you could get shut out and then they don't tell you anything anymore and everything's happening in secret. So it can be very hard. I've seen and talked to individuals who've been what I call divorced from their bank because they've given so much of their life savings overseas and the bank can't support that transfer anymore because they would be in trouble with the federal government as to potentially supporting activities that shouldn't be internationally. So they had been a lifelong customer of the bank and hated to see him go, but they couldn't get through to the consumer. So very difficult space.
Preying on loneliness. It just makes me so angry.
In emotion.
Yeah.
That's the key, because they want it to be real so bad that they're willing to overlook those red flags than the other individuals, which is why Michelle says you have to be so delicate in how you make sure you don't push them away, because they want it to be real.
Yeah, yeah, and that, understandably. I mean, it's kind of a lonely planet. So, you know, when that opportunity comes up, trust and verify. Don't trust and verify. Whatever you do, verify it.
Yeah, but when you are the support person for the one who's engaged, bring in others to help you navigate it as well. And certainly don't blame, don't point fingers. You will get shut out very quickly.
Thank you, Michelle. Let's go back to your calls now with the time we have left with our guests, Michelle Ryan and Michael Domke, our consumer protection experts. Paul, we'll go to you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Excellent program. I love all the ideas and tips. They've been hearing you talking about accessing the credit report. But isn't there a way you can also somehow lock out your credit so that a new card can't be applied for? How do you do that? And then how hard is that to undo?
There are, as I understand it, three credit reporting agencies that you would go to. Can you do it singularly or do you have to go to all three?
You have to do it singularly. You do have to go to all three individually because they each have their own process, which is a little unique. Okay. You get a PIN and password for each one so that you can put on a temporary thaw when you do need an extension of credit and they need to check your credit report. You work with your lender, whoever that will be, to say who are you going to be checking, and you can thaw all three or one or two, and that will then get frozen again after that check is done. And then there's a way to permanently remove it should you ever want to do that again. But you do need to go to all three, and we have all that information on our website.
Okay.
So we'll direct people there because then we've got it locked down as to what they're getting for that information. So go to the datcp.wi.gov website and just go under consumer protection fact sheets, and you'll be able to do a security freeze is what it is. And I'm going to circle back on the annualcreditreport.com. Yeah. There is also a phone number if people, if that's easier for individuals to navigate, but there it's the once a year, you know, the
mail,
regular.
By mail.
Yep, by mail. And that is 877-322-8228. So there was one individual who's having trouble with the website and weren't sure if she's going to the right or wrong one, but having struggles. She may want to call if she was going to the correct website.
877-322-8228.
That's correct.
All right. We'll also have that up at WPR.org/Larry. And how easy is it to unfreeze your credit once you do freeze it?
Slick.
Very easy.
Okay.
They say it should take less than an hour.
Oh, wow. It almost feels like preemptively it's not the worst idea to freeze your credit and then unfreeze it when you need it.
Absolutely. And when Michael says less than an hour, that's not for you to go through the process to unfreeze. That's for you put in the info you needed unfreeze and then to go and do that.
Yeah.
Nice. Thanks for calling, Paul. Great question. Kimberly and Cable, we'll go to you next. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I have an iPhone. And for quite a while now, when I wanted set up a new account, it'll give me the option of using their password. And I'll look at the password, and it's long and complicated. You know, it looks like a good one. And sometimes I'll make up my own, and sometimes I'll choose theirs. Do your guests have any opinion on the safety of using those pre-chosen passwords?
Yeah, my Google machines do the same thing, Kimberly. It said, would you like to use this password? And it'd be a string of gibberish that I would never remember and probably would write down wrong. But it would also be difficult to replicate, I would imagine, but maybe not so tough to steal.
You know, we're not the tech gurus to really be able to distinguish one versus the other. And I know that there is also Larry has the computer show regularly, yep, and yep. Computer Day. I'd probably suggest calling in with that question to them to really differentiate between the two. Ours is unique, long, strong. Auto-generated is certainly going to provide that. It needs to be usable for you. So if you're using the token one that they're giving you, you're probably always going to be dependent upon that device. And then how do you get in if you need to get in from a different device because it may be too complex to remember or if that device breaks down? So different factors to consider in selecting how you're going to create that long and strong password passphrase.
Yeah, I would trust the randomization offering that they have, but then the secondary part is where you say, do you want to trust now, as Michelle mentioned, the token that's saving and now the device saving it and it having that internal password manager. So the randomization, I mean, it would be tough for us to randomly come up with something that's more complex right. or hard to get into than that. But it's the features afterwards that you want to consider.
A password that is unique, long, and strong. That's memorable. I can keep that in mind. We'll go to Vivian in Green Bay next. Vivian, good afternoon.
Hello. I'd like your comments on the wisdom and cautions about two strategies I use. My day-to-day credit card has a rather low limit, so no one can go out and buy a car. And then my checking account does not have overdraft protection.
Hmm.
So write a really big check if they get one of my checks.
They would bounce. Vivian's idea is good. Low lines of credit on the credit card and no overdraft protection?
The low balance on the day-to-day for the credit card certainly would limit if somebody were to have that compromise. Now, I don't know where they would top it out at how much you could go over, and so it would potentially limit what her liability is if that card was compromised. As to the no overdraft, certainly that comes with some risks. If that also were to be compromised,
sure.
And how much they could deplete. We do also always talk about, you know, when you have that and then information, are those accounts linked? What notifications do you have? I would go back to when we were talking earlier about signing up with that bank of the notification of saying, hey, was there an individual charge? Now, that's just going to tell you there was a charge, but hopefully gives you an opportunity to call the bank right away.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily going to stop the transaction that had occurred already, and then you're going to have to go through those steps to explain and justify how that was fraud.
Vivian, thank you for the call. Michael Domke, Michelle Ryan, thank you so much for all this useful information today. You have certainly changed some of my habits going forward and made me think twice about what I find online, in my mailbox, on my cell phone. It's a strange world out there, and you got to protect yourself. Thank you both so much for helping us do it.
Well, thanks, Lee, having us.
Michael Domke is the director of the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection's Bureau of Consumer Protection, and Michelle Ryan, the administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. Up next, we take a look at separating the wheat from the chaff, the information from the misinformation, and how we can stop the spread of that misinformation online. An information communication expert joins us next on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is WPR News. So when you read something online, whether you catch it on social media or another website, how do you know it's true? Or how do you know that these are the facts? Who can you trust? I'd like to know. It's perhaps gotten more difficult, and with the advent of artificial intelligence, has this changed the way we interact with our content? How do you verify online? You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Separating the information from the other than information, the facts from the disinformation. You can also email us anytime, talk@WPR.org. Our guest to help us separate the two this afternoon is Kate Hinnant. She's the head of communication at UW-Eau Claire's McIntyre Library. And Kate, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a little bit about you and how you became interested in misinformation. What's your story?
Well, it's kind of embarrassing, but about 10 years ago, I was reading through my Facebook feed and I came across a news story that got me all excited. I thought it was a real game changer. I thought, this is going to really change everything. And as I started to go ahead and share it with all of my friends and family, I paused for a second because it almost seemed too good to be true. And so I did what most librarians would do, and I went to the web and started to find corroborating sources. I wanted to find someone else who was saying the same thing. And indeed, I did find one other site, but it was exactly the same, and it turned out it was the same company that put out both news sites. But what I, as I searched and searched, I realized what they had done was taken one piece of information and blow it completely out of proportion. So I caught myself before I shared that information with everybody. But then it occurred to me, like, okay, so I'm a trained librarian. Mm-hmm. I almost fell for this. What is a person who hasn't gone through that training supposed to do to protect themselves from falling for disinformation?
Well, in your story, which is far from uncommon, Kate, and I think we've all fallen victim to this, is the idea of our own biases and how our biases, it's just the way we have, the tools we have to try to interact with the world as social animals and beings. But the bias I hear from that story and so many others that we spread is a confirmation bias. We do this because it sounds like, well, we want to believe in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think those are the stories. Well, there's two sides to that. There's wanting to believe it and wanting not to believe it. And those, I think, are the same, the same confirmation bias, but in different directions. Because if you read something that kind of goes against your beliefs, you're going to be like, nah, that can't be true, mm-hmm. Without necessarily checking it. So yeah, definitely confirmation bias and that emotional component of, I really want this to be true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or I really don't want it to be true, and therefore it's not. Or I want it to be true, and therefore it is. This confirmation bias is built in each and every one of us. It's not something that... it's not something anybody doesn't have, but it's important to recognize it. So how do I start consuming information online through a lens that identifies my own bias, Kate?
Yeah, and so some of the methods that people have been coming up with first are, like, the first step is actually just that, like, check your emotion. Mm. Check how you're reacting to this piece. But another... piece of it is actually, like I said, just sort of leaving the source, leaving whatever you're looking at, whether it's a meme or an article or, maybe it's a video, and seeing what other people are saying. And in fact, it was about 8 years ago, Stanford University did a study where they took history professors, history students, and professional fact checkers. And they gave them all the same sources, and they told them to evaluate them. And funnily enough, the history professors and students did about the same, which was relatively poorly and relatively slowly. And the fact checkers were able to very quickly sort of arrive at a really good evaluation. And one of the reasons was that the professors and students were stuck on the source. They were looking at it really closely. They were analyzing lines, like the lines in the text. They were looking at all the features. They were falling for things like professional-looking logos. And the fact checkers were, like, just sort of immediately just opening up tabs and searching, what is this source? who are these people? What are other people saying about this? And they were able to come to conclusions much faster. And so that's the method that we've been trying to teach our students here at the university for sort of like, it is work. I mean, it's not.
Sure.
I mean, like you said earlier, it was easier in the old days when we didn't have 100,000 sources, and, you know.
Yeah. So, but the first step is check your emotion and understand that you're going to have an emotional response to it. And what that may be does not lend towards the veracity of what you're reading at all. It's just your reaction to it, understanding your own bias to it. Second is leave that primary source and then verify. I would imagine, Kate, we would go out and try to verify with secondary and third sources even, if we could.
Yes, right, exactly. And there are, you know, different techniques. You can look up the title of the source. You can look up the author. You can go and take the, sometimes I take the, just like the headline or the main point, and I copy and paste it into Google and see, either have other people written about this particular source, or what have other people said about the concepts in this source?
Kate Hinnant, our guest, head of communication at UW-Eau Claire's McIntyre Library, working to separate the information from the other than information that we find and read online, whether it's social media or elsewhere. Talking about the sources, Kate, and how do we figure out which sources to trust, which sources that we know that... that would present the facts before they would present the speculation?
Well, and I mean, I think this is the hard part of it, is mm-hmm. that even sources that we know and we trust, you really still, you know, like, I mean, like, first of all, there's a distinction made sometimes by some people between misinformation and disinformation. And even reliable sources make mistakes. Like, misinformation is when you mistakenly say something that's false. Disinformation is when you say it on purpose because you're trying to, you know, get a certain effect. So when you're reading your trusted sources, you know, they also make mistakes. So, you know, you may want to even verify them. But I think what is really just difficult, like I said, we've got so many sources out there. It's kind of great in a way, but it is also really daunting to find out, you know, like, how do you find out whether this source, you know, like, whether this source is considered trustworthy? And I usually Google the sources. And, you know, for the larger sources, Wikipedia usually has entries on them. There are other people who write about reliability of sources that you can find. But it really is, it does require investigation in a way that, like, when I was a kid, you know, you went to the library and you knew that everything that was there was considered trustworthy.
Yeah.
Now I can no longer say that because we curate millions of sources.
Wow. So I feel like, what about when the consequences of when you get information wrong, and whether or not we could apply some sort of credibility to the sources depending on how they react when they are when their information is disproven, whether it be disinformation or misinformation? You know, when a journalist gets it wrong, they may not just lose their career or job, they may lose their career. When a politician gets it wrong, they may just be able to run for re-election and ride with it. I wonder about consequences of wrong information and how that may lend itself to understanding credibility at all, Kate.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think that the... like the sources or the, you know, publications that we consider probably, I mean, that most people would consider highly credible, still do that work of putting in retractions, of, mm-hmm. You know, correcting the record. The problem with retractions is the same problem with all corrections for disinformation, and that is that the people who saw the original mistake or intended deceit won't necessarily see the corrections. And, you know, that's just that's been a problem for all of history of writing.
Right, right. Because the big, bold headlines above the fold of the old newspaper is never where you're going to find the correction, or at least almost never. That might be in section C at the bottom of page 4 on the back page somewhere.
Exactly.
And that's, yeah, and it's that has never changed. But when it comes to stopping the spread of disinformation or misinformation, what role do each and every one of us play as you see it, Kate?
Well, I think that, I mean, for one thing, like individuals can, I mean, one of the reasons why people are so aware of disinformation now is that it spreads so easily on social media. Right. That, I mean, there's always been disinformation. There's always been misinformation, but there hasn't always been social media that can spread it and amplify it. And so I think just doing that sort of checking your emotions before you share something and doing the, I mean, even if you don't do the full, like, I'm going to look up everything about this and correct it, just being really careful about that, because that is really part of the issue, is that, you know, it's so easy to spread, spread misinformation now. But I mean, I don't think it's all up to individuals either. And I think that this is thinking about ways that social media companies, governments can tackle this problem. It's, you know, it's complicated because, like, we believe in free speech, right?
Right.
I mean, why shouldn't you be able to lie? But there also is that question of harms. And there is increasingly plenty of evidence that certain types of disinformation cause harm to people. And so that's where, you know, really stepping in a thoughtful way that's not about squashing, you know, people's ability to express themselves, express their political points of view, but is also protecting people from, you know, the harms that can happen.
It feels as though this is something that social media networks have always struggled with and have gone back and forth on and still have not settled on something that would prevent harm while also providing a forum for free speech, Kate.
Yeah, and they have they have a sort of difficult situation too, because it's not just, you know, what we would consider classic disinformation. They also have to deal with, you know, threats. They have to deal with what we call, what is also sometimes called malinformation, which is when people put true information out there to hurt other people, which is kind of like, things like swatting people or doxing them or putting nudes up, you know, like your partner breaks up with you and you put their nudes on the internet.
Yeah.
So they have a whole swath of sort of harmful speech that they have to deal with. And I think right now we're in a period where the social media companies are stepping back and saying, like, well, we don't know how to do this, so we're just gonna, like, not do anything.
It's funny how I jump to personal responsibility, and then you bring up the larger picture that there is a role to play for the forums that we see this free speech on and the government that oversees all of this. Now, while there is a First Amendment right to free speech that is protecting us against the government, but that First Amendment does not apply necessarily to Facebook or Twitter, does it?
Right. You're right. Yeah. And that's the case where, right now, we're in this period where they're sort of like, what would we call it, self-regulating.
Mm-hmm.
But they do have more, leeway to actually take action if they wanted to. And I think that, lately, the European Union, who has done, like, incredible work over the last 10 years of thinking through these problems and developing policies and laws about disinformation, they have been fining social media companies like Facebook. They're large fines, but probably to Facebook they're peanuts. But but because they're violating their laws of, you know, sort of taking responsibility for, the safety of the users.
Yes, but the European Union doesn't have the First Amendment. But then again, social media doesn't have to, the government can't encroach on free speech, but Facebook and Twitter, formerly Twitter, now X, can. Kate Hinnant is our guest. She's a head of communication at UW-Eau Claire's McIntyre Library, and we are trying to work through how to best separate the information from the disinformation, the misinformation, and now the malinformation, and what we can do to stop the spread of those things that end up being untrue. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry, and this is The Larry Mueller Show. Separating the facts from, well, just about everything else online and what we can do to stop the spread of the things that are untrue on the internet. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today on The Larry Mueller Show. Our guest, Kate Hinnant, is the head of communication at UW-Eau Claire's McIntyre Library. And so far, we've come up with this checklist. Check your emotion, understanding we all have an emotional response to it. None of it lends itself towards whether or not this is factually accurate. So then leave the source where you found it and go and see if you can find another trusted source that can verify the information that you see. And then stop the spread of this misinformation at every point you can. And there may be a role for the forums that we use, social media networks to play. There may be a role for government to play. But Kate, then I think of such things like deep fakes and manipulated videos and how those play a role in all of this and whether or not there can be some sort of federal law that would stop the spread of deep fakes, manipulated videos, and things that are untrue, even though it would seem to be with our own eyes.
Yeah, that's a really great question, and I think that we're starting to see some of that play out in court cases. Because if you generate a truly deep fake of somebody, you know, like you're not actually taking a real photo or but you're manipulating it to they have plenty of times manipulated people to say things or whatever. So like, To what extent is that a creation, and to what extent is it actually, considered something like, closer to like libel or whatever?
Sure.
There's been a lot of talk about people creating, like nudes of people with AI.
Yep.
And it's technically not their body. But at the same time, the effect can be the same.
What would you like to see the government's role be in fighting against disinformation and malinformation, Kate?
I think that one of the things is that I think that they could do more to strengthen the responsibility of online platforms. For protecting their users. I mentioned the EU earlier, and they have actually spent quite a bit of, time and money creating education for teaching students in schools, teaching adults about, disinformation, about detecting it. So then the other thing is they had the idea that, one of the reasons why people believe in disinformation is because they don't trust, authorities. And so what should the government do? Well, their answer was we need to become more transparent.
Transparency.
We need to make sure that our citizens in each of the countries has access to, information about the decisions we are making as a government. And that's kind of a really novel and advanced way of thinking about it. And I don't know that that would bear fruit immediately, but, I think it's a good good insight into why, people might turn to disinformation rather than, believing their government or believing authorities.
Well, let me bring you a story from NPR.org from the Oval Office yesterday as President Donald Trump hosted the South African president. And quoting from the story here, Trump again and again repeated a right-wing conspiracy theory that there is systematic persecution and genocide of white South Africans using disinformation to support his allegations. He misrepresented a video showing a protest where people placed white crosses in a field to commemorate a farmer and his wife who were murdered in a 2020 home robbery as a, quote, burial site. South African news site News 24 said there are no bodies at the site and the number of crosses do not relate to the number of killings. That is an end quote from NPR.org. But when you're talking about government being more transparent, and then you're talking about what's being talked about inside the Oval Office from the President of the United States, where do we go with that when it comes to information and malinformation and disinformation?
Well, that's, yes. Where do we go when it's our own government producing the disinformation? And I think that's an interesting story because I noticed yesterday when I was looking at that, the headlines that different news organizations had about that story were very different. So NPR and I think Washington Post right out front said, I can't remember, but essentially that this was
falsehoods.
Not true.
Yes.
Yeah, falsehoods, yes. Other news sources chose to cushion it a little bit more and not say that it was falsehoods, which I think is a big mistake because I think regardless of whoever is producing the disinformation, you want to get out there right away and have the correct information in front of the readers because once the story gets going, it's very hard to correct people's, they're thinking about the story that Trump told.
Right.
And they're not thinking about the fact that it's a lie.
This goes to the heart of what you're talking about trusting the source. And trusting the source means building credibility, which is something that public media is focused on. I know this from the inside out every day, a little bit at a time, because it can be destroyed instantly. But it's also about stopping the spread before it starts. And that is incumbent on, to some degree, I would imagine, on the source to be responsible for as well.
Right, exactly. And I mean, I know this is a difficult situation, you know, like it's the president.
Right.
But at the same time, if you don't address it, you're basically amplifying it.
So then what's my I'll go back to personal responsibility again.
Okay.
And what my role is I have in stopping the spread in making sure that facts are presented and not something other than facts.
Yeah. Well, as individuals, obviously, there's only so much we can do. And I think that is, we've talked about, you know, the fact that social media is, helps spread it. We've talked about a little bit about AI. And if you think about it, AI is like the next revolution in disinformation.
Oh, dear.
It is so easy to produce scads of disinformation now. Like it used to be like 8 years ago, you had to, hire some Macedonian boys to, type into the computer all day and sort of like, mastermind these small disinformation campaigns. Now one person can use AI to just produce like, I don't even know.
Well, let me give you a great example. Just this week, Kate, we had Daniel Golden from a bookstore in Milwaukee on to give us a reading list of summer books that he would recommend. It was a great list of 20 books. And on that same day, the Chicago Sun-Times ran a book list, a summer recommended reading list that ended up being developed by artificial intelligence. And they found that out when they realized that the authors that were reported to have written these books never wrote the titles that were listed in the recommended book series. That struck me.
Yes, that was a really how it got up there, how it got published, it was yanked down fairly quickly, but how it even got published is a question to me. I saw something today about authors who forgot to take the AI prompts out of their books.
Oh.
So, you know, you see where the AI is responding to their query and then producing the text. You know, there's a, yeah, I mean, like, we're talking about, like, you know, I mean, the Washington Post, I'd really like to know the story behind that one.
Very interesting.
About how that book list was created and who did it and you know, like, and why, you know.
Well, it also turns out the newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, ran that same summer reading list that was developed by artificial intelligence. And it just, I mean, it's hard not to be cynical, but I guess be skeptical, maybe don't trust, but verify. We've come up with some steps here, Kate, but it feels a little overwhelming that the facts are being washed out by everything else.
Yeah, it, yeah, I mean, I think the steps are crucial to us as individuals, but I think we also need to think about what we can do collectively to decide, like, this is not the way we want our information.
Yeah, Kate, I want to thank
our information ecosystem to be. And in the European Union, 82% of people believe that disinformation is a problem for democracy. I'm not sure we have that kind of consensus in the United States yet.
But we're going to.
But I think that. What? Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, we're out of time, so I'm sorry. We're going to need to get there in order for something to be done larger than just our own individual personal responsibility. Kate, I want to thank you for your time and wisdom this afternoon. Kate Hinnant is the head of communications at UW-Eau Claire's McIntyre Library. I want to thank our team for putting this all together today: Clara Neipert, Joel Patnaud, Jeff Robbins, and Jill Nadeau. I want to thank Larry Mueller graciously for having me, giving me the honor of being able to sit in for him today. I am Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to The Larry Mueller Show.